Okay. All right, we're now broadcasting on the audio as well, so somebody wants to anybody wants to listen that way, you're welcome to go to the live link. If the sim happens to fill up, you can let people know that link.
Is that the right link, Bunty?
Yep, that's the right link, thank you. Okay, so welcome everyone. We're a little bit early, but I think we'll just get started. So today I thought something a little bit different. And I know you've been, apparently been, someone's been reading Jataka stories, but nonetheless I have one particular Jataka that's interesting to me that I'd like to talk about. Try not to just read it off, I'll try to talk about it as well. But this April we will be holding a interfaith storytelling event on the topic of environmental protection, religion and the environment. We being the Hamilton Interfaith Peace Group, which is a neat group. The two people heading it are a Baha'i professor at McMaster University and a Presbyterian. I don't think he's a minister, I think he's just a devout follower of his Presbyterian church. And anyway, I'm on their steering committee or whatever we called it, and I'm also going to be one of the presenters at the storytelling event. And so the idea was to find stories that relate to nature or the environment or the importance of or caring for our environment, at least being aware of the importance of the world around us in our spiritual practice. And so this story was told about, this story is actually not about, it wasn't told as a lesson in the importance of nature. It just happens to be one that dovetails nicely with the environment, and it's sort of exemplary of the Buddhist view of nature. Buddhism isn't, I mean, early Buddhist texts aren't openly protective of nature, as in consciously being concerned about its protection. The closest you get are things like the Buddha saying it's hard to find forests anymore. People cutting down the forests in India. Or monks not being allowed to cut to harm plant life. But none of that's really conclusive. Probably the best, the closest you could get to the idea of protecting nature would be the importance of living in the forest and the appreciation. I'd say there's certainly an appreciation of nature throughout the early Buddhist texts. But a couple of things is, first of all, of course, in 2,500 years ago, there wasn't the concern over the environment, not to the same level as we have it today. But second of all, Buddhism hits a much more core issue with its focus on greed and the stressing of contentment, to the point that anyone following these Buddhist teachings shouldn't have to be concerned about the environment, because they've already dedicated themselves or directed themselves in such a way as to be protective of the environment, or protective at least in the sense of non-destruct, non-harmful, living a life that conserves or preserves the environment. So this is actually a story about contentment, which I think is one of the key issues that are being neglected as far as those that impact the environment. And I bring up greed as well, greed and its opposite of contentment, and I would single those out as really the two key killers in the environment. I mean, it's nice to want to recycle and want to be conscious of our choices, but inevitably we can't have our cake and eat it too. You can't destroy the you can't get everything you want, or you can't pursue this incessant and obsessive path of desiring more and more, consuming more and more, and expect to conserve the beauty and the nature and the peace and the harmony of the world. You know, in the end, all we'll have left, no offense, but all we'll have left is places like this, which are, no matter how beautiful this, the Buddha Center might be, it's no replacement for the natural world. Anyway, so on with the story. It's the Mahasukha Jataka, number 429. And so the story goes that there was this monk living in a forest near a border village in the Kosala country. And he had learned how to meditate from the Buddha and then gone off on his own to live. And the place that he lived, he was able to get pretty much anything he wanted. He lived in a place where there were a lot of people and a lot of religious people. So they would support him with alms, whether they were Buddhist or not. It wasn't a thing at the in that time in India. People just supported religious people, so they would give him food and probably give him quite luxurious gifts and support. So not only was he well taken care of, he was probably pampered. And this has always been common in religious circles. And when you go to a place where there's a high volume of people, it's pretty easy to live and to actually become somewhat indulgent, live in opulence, even as an ascetic, hence the need for all the rules. So there were all these rules that monks had to keep, and well, to some extent that helps. At any rate, he seems to have gotten a little bit spoiled by it. Having said that, he was... Well, what happened is the village burnt down. The whole town around him burnt down, fields and houses and everything. And everybody was suddenly reduced to poverty. And suddenly he was not so well taken care of. And so to be fair to him, he was put in a position that wasn't just about living with little. It was perhaps living with some great hardship. That being said, that really is par for the course, or it's part of the package that you're signing up for when you become a Buddhist monk. I mean, I've been there, not having food or having very little food. It's actually quite liberating to just let go and be at peace with that. But he couldn't do that, so he was quite upset and his meditation suffered. And so the Buddha came to him and said, he went to the Buddha after the rains and he said, look, I can't stay there, this is really too tough. And he said, it's really, or he didn't, he just said, you know, this is the problem. And the Buddha said, well, in that case, you ought to be content with whatever you have, live off of whatever people give you, and be content with that, because that's the way of the ancients, that's the way in the olden days. People practiced religious life. And they said, even animals are able to be content when they live in a place that is suitable for their lives. They don't worry about, you know, they don't go flying off looking for a better place. They're content and they live through hardship. Even animals are able to do that. And he said, why would you be so quick to fly away and find a new place? So it's maybe a little bit surprising to people who would think, wow, the Buddha really expects a lot, but you have to understand what is the core of the Buddha's message. It's about rising above samsara and these preconceptions we have that it must be like this, and preconceptions of health, for example, that if you don't eat enough, you're undernourished, and so on. Preconceptions about so many things. You know, like we take vitamins and we try to eat all this good food, concerned about it, saying, well, I have to stay in good health. But what really does that mean? Does good health mean being able to stay alive, or does it mean being virile? Virile? Being potent, right? A lot of health has to do with being able to exercise and have sex and play sports and games and fight. You know, a lot of it's to kill. Yeah, this is the old instincts that we have. And then in fact, if you just talk about being alive, and furthermore, keeping your mind from giving into obsession, you really don't need a lot. In fact, you're much better when you're being tested, when you're forced to deal with all sorts of circumstances. So anyway, in order to drive this home, he tells a story. And I think it's a cute story. Maybe it's kind of a silly story, but once upon a time, myriads of parrots lived in the Himalaya countries on the banks of the Ganges in a grove of fig trees. A king of the parrots there, when the fruit of the tree in which he dwelt had come to an end, ate whatever was left, whether shoot or leaf or bark or rind, and drank of water from the Ganges, and being very happy and contented, he kept where he was. Owing to his happy and contented state, the abode of Sakka was shaken. Sakka, reflecting on the cause, saw the parrot, and to test his virtue by his supernatural power, he withered up the tree, which became a mere stump perforated with holes, and stood to be buffeted by every blast of wind, and from the holes dust came out. The parrot king ate this dust and drank the water of the Ganges, and going nowhere else, sat perched on the top of the fig stump, reckoning not of wind and sun. Sakka noticed how very contented the parrot was, and said, after hearing him speak of the virtue of friendship, I will come and give him his choice of a boon, and cause the fig tree to bear ambrosial fruit. So he took the form of a royal goose, and preceded by Sujja, in the shape of an asura nymph, he went to the grove of fig trees, and perching on the bough of a tree close by, he entered into conversation with the parent and spoke the first stanza. Wherever fruitful trees abound, a flock of hungry birds is found. But should the trees all withered be, away at once the birds will flee. And after these words, to drive the parrot thence, he spoke the second stanza. Haste thee, Sir Redbeak, to be gone. Why dost thou sit and dream alone? Come tell me, prithee, bird of spring, to this dead stump, why dost thou cling? Then the parrot said, O goose, from a feeling of gratitude I forsake not this tree. And he repeated two stanzas. They who have been close friends from youth, mindful of goodness and of truth, in life and death, in weal and woe, the claims of friendship ne'er forgo. I too would fain be kind and good to one that long my friend has stood. I wish to live, but have no heart from this old tree, though dead, to part. Sakka, on hearing what he said, was delighted, and praising him, wished to offer him a choice, and uttered two stanzas. I know thy friendship and thy grateful love, virtues that wise men surely must approve. I offer thee whatever thou wilt for choice. Parrot, what boon would most thy heart rejoice? On hearing this, the parrot, making his choice, spoke the seventh stanza. If thou, O goose, what most I crave wouldst give, grant that the tree I love again may live. Let it once more with its old vigor shoot, gather fresh sweetness and bear goodly fruit. Then Sakka, granting the boon, spoke the eighth stanza. Lo, friend, a fruitful and right noble tree, well fitted for thy dwelling place to be. Let it once more with its old vigor shoot, gather fresh sweetness and bear goodly fruit. With these words, Sakka quitted his present form, and manifesting the supernatural power of himself and Suja, he took up water from the Ganges in his hand and dashed it against the fig tree stump. Straightway the tree rose up, rich in branch and stem and with honey-sweet fruit, and stood a charming sight like unto the bare jewel mount. The parrot king, on seeing it, was highly pleased, and singing the praises of Sakka, he spoke the ninth stanza. May Sakka and all loved by Sakka blessed be, as I today am blessed this goodly sight to see. Sakka, after granting the parrot his choice and causing the fig tree to bear ambrosial fruit, returned with Sujata to his own abode. In illustration of this story, these stanzas inspired by perfect wisdom were added at the close. So this is the Buddha himself speaking. Soon as King Parrot wisely made his choice, the tree once more put forth its fruit again. Then Sakka with his king did fly amain to where in Nandana the gods rejoice. It's not such an important stanza. That's the story. The importance of it is in regards to the contentment, and also in regards to the loyalty. There's another story in here, I think, about, or there's somewhere a simile of a tree branch. You don't cut down a tree if you've ever gotten shade from the tree. There's several similes about this sort of thing. So, I mean, this kind of has, I mean, you could certainly, and I probably will at this forum, talk about how Robin is echoing me. Talk about how it relates to the environment. So, so that the environment is something we should be aware of, that it has supported us. And I'm not sure how much you want to anthropomorphize nature in terms of saying we have to be thankful to the trees and faithful and loyal to them. Not really convinced by that argument, but it's a good sort of attitude to take, that things that help you, it's important to recognize their value. Like Joni Mitchell said, don't always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So as we, as a species, begin to pave paradise, it's this sort of thing that we should be giving thought to, and contemplating on how we're treating the environment, how we're treating the tree under which we find shade, the tree under which we have found shade. And so on the one hand, as Buddhists, we recognize the importance of not clinging, not clinging to the past. But it's easy, and it does happen in Buddhist societies, for this to translate in not caring about those things that are important. In Buddhist countries, they tend to have a fairly poor record of environment. I don't know if that's fair. I think Sri Lanka's done okay, and I suppose some of the Mahayana countries have done okay. I know Thailand's done fairly poorly. Burma as well, I think. I don't know if you could connect that with Buddhism at all, but I do know Buddhists can be somewhat callous about the environment. Callous about nature. Because they think, just let it go. Don't cling. Don't hold on. Which is really basic. What they're really doing is not being aware. And though we don't want to obsess or be too fixated on anything, I think what this story really does show is how we should be aware. We should be conscious of those things that support us. And it only hurts us if we neglect them, if we just abandon that which is important, nature being one of those things. Anyway, so just one of those things. That's all I had to say. No talk today beyond that. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer them. Looks like a bunch of new people.
If you have a question.
If you're interested in some of the things I do, you can look up my profile. Okay, go ahead.
Satyabhante, if anyone has a questions, please type a one so that not everyone speak at once. Thank you, Bhante. That's a really wonderful story.
Oh, good. So go ahead and talk. If anyone wants to turn on voice, go ahead.
Please go ahead, Taylor.
I just want to thank you deeply for sharing that story. I like to consider myself as one who is committed to the tree and faithful to the tree, even when it becomes poorly. And I felt very touched by that part of the story. And I thank you for sharing that, and it's just beautiful. So thank you.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You guys are sort of my guinea pig, because guinea pig is a horrible saying. You guys are my test subject. So now I've read it once. I know how to. I'll be familiar with it when time comes to read it in front of people. Yeah, I don't like talking about guinea pigs or lab rats, because we've just been talking about the environment, and it's not really something you should be... I mean, we should be condemning that sort of thing. Lab rats and guinea pigs in general. I don't know, I'm safe in saying that as Buddhists, that's one of the horrible things that humanity has fallen into. How do we protect the tree? Well, I don't know that Buddhism is so much about protecting the tree. As I said, Buddhism is much more about changing people's hearts. Because cutting down one tree isn't such a big deal, but our mass slaughter of the environment, it comes from something different. It comes from greed. It comes from consumerism and this incessant, obsessive, passionate drive for sensual pleasure and materialism and that kind of thing. So yeah, if we practice spirituality and love and compassion, and contentment, really. Contentment, I think, is something that is underrepresented in spirituality. So spiritual people can, at times, be somewhat indulgent themselves. It's not, of course, across the board, but it is possible, because there can be the indulgence of one's desires and so on, which can lead to excess. But contentment is key. You know, there's the three R's: reduce, reuse, recycle. I've been an environmentalist since, gosh, I don't know how long. My parents were in the anti-nuke movement, trying to stop them from burying nuclear waste in our backyard in Northern Ontario, and to stop them from opening a nuclear power plant in Northern Ontario, that kind of thing. And so I learned about all these things. I was the head of the environmental committee at school. And but what's interesting is the three R's: reduce, reuse, recycle. My stepmother once pointed out to me something that stuck with me for a long time, and as a Buddhist it resonates a lot. They're in an order for a reason. You know, what's the one that we focus on the most? Recycle. Recycle is the last one, and it's the last one for a reason. It's not the best one. It's the worst of the three. It's the least useful of the three. Reduce. Reduce beats everything. If you reduce, you know, recycling is a bit of a, it can be a bit of a sham, a bit of a scam. Well, not a scam, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly the figures, and I know recycling is good, but it's one of those things that can be at times a feel good. I was doing recycling in high school, and we had to look into all this, and it was a real, you know, it was nice to be able to say we were doing it, but it's a lot of work, and a lot of work goes into recycling, right? A lot of energy goes into it. Anyway, it's a good thing, especially with things like cardboard and so on, but reduce beats it, you know, by a order of magnitude. And then reuse as well is not as good, because you're still consuming, because you still have to consume the first time. But when you reuse, you don't use it the second time. But that's interesting from a Buddhist point of view, because that's kind of points to our that points to what I was saying, is it's not about these proactive things like recycling. It's like, don't use in the first place, you know. Don't go that way in the first place. The environment isn't a mess because we're not recycling. That's not the case. It's a mess because we're using in the first place. We're overusing. And that comes from greed. That comes from all the things that Buddhism is talking about. So, there you go, Buddhism and the environment. Not something I normally talk about, but I've been asked to tell this story. So I've only got 12 minutes to tell it. It took me, I think, 5 to tell the actual story, so I'll have some extra time. Didn't realize it was only going to take 5 minutes or 7 minutes. There's another interesting story in Buddhism about how the earth describes the degradation of the earth in sync with our degradation as beings. So it points to this trend that started when we were angels or celestial beings floating around the earth, and as we consumed of the earth, our bodies became coarser and the earth itself became coarser, and it's just gotten more and more coarse and unrefined, and our bodies are becoming more and more coarse and unrefined, apparently. Which I guess makes sense. I mean, the human body is probably one of the ugliest. Well, maybe. I don't know about that, actually. But if you look at animal bodies, they're much more elegant, right? The human body, I mean, what are we? We go bald. I'm going bald. We've got hair coming out of everywhere for no good reason. It's an interesting point, because normally we would say that humans are higher than animals, but I'm not so sure. I mean, we're higher in terms of intelligence, mindfulness, that kind of thing, but we're getting coarser and coarser as beings. You know, before with survival of the fittest, there was an elegance to it, a horrible, horrific, evil elegance, in the sense of there was a culling process. And thankfully we're not doing that. But I don't know. That's quite complicated. That's an interesting topic, because absolutely we don't want to be going back to survival of the fittest. But there's got to be something in there about our. At least you could say the contentment with our grossness. So we're okay with, like, I think you could even, and this is controversial, some people may not want to hear this, but, you know, if you're born with something, some condition, to accept that is some karmic result, and to work to improve in the future, it's kind of a thing that we're doing less now, so we're more about accepting and being okay with, and you know, I hope I don't sound, that doesn't sound awful, but I think there's something in there. Obviously we should never treat people as lesser, and a person who is born with a disability or whatever, or who acquires a disability or however, should not be treated as lesser and should not be looked down, and there is a danger of that. Some Buddhists actually tend to look down on those who have suffering, but that's a horrible misunderstanding of the Buddhist way. What we look down upon and what we shun is evil. And so we recognize that evil may have caused certain imperfections in us, you know, or certain causes of suffering, right? If it's not causing you suffering, that's one thing. And so we do our best to try and mitigate that. But if it is causing you suffering, we understand that that cause is comes from evil. But that being said, a person can have a imperfection or whatever, and still of the body, and still be perfect in the mind or clear in the mind. Anyway, just some thoughts. Please don't take any of that the wrong way. This is all just sort of speculation and stray thought. Anyway. Puritanical thinking is dangerous. No, but I think there's something to accepting the consequences of our deeds. And whereas we don't want to look down on others, if I have, you know, if there's something wrong with me, I mean, I guess I'm quite well off, so it's hard for me to say, but I don't feel disinclined to accept and say, well, yeah, it's probably a lot to do with karma. I mean, Buddhists do that with a lot of things. When things happen to us, we accept results. So, I don't know, I was just trying to tie it in, but it's so complicated to the idea that, I mean, the general point is that our karma these days is definitely more coarse. We're getting very much obsessed with instant gratification. And that has a result, that has a consequences, as we can see in the world around us. The world around us is less beautiful than it was thousands of years ago. That's, I think, an objective truth. There's an island of plastic, the size of Texas. You could argue that that's just, it's just still just nature. But I don't think it's arguable that that's as refined or as harmonious. The world is not as harmonious as it was. And I don't mean in terms of war or anything. I just mean the nature. Pollution, this kind of thing. I mean, it's more complicated, more coarse. The pollution in the big cities, take that. So I was just trying to tie it into our inner selves as well. Our bodies are probably becoming more coarse as a result. I mean, that's very much Buddhist, in line with Buddhist way of thinking. Yeah, I mean, I don't exactly agree. I mean, to me, compassion isn't the most important. Wisdom is more important to me than compassion, but I know different schools of Buddhism have different thoughts on the subject. For me, it's about understanding. But compassion's good, important. And just in my school, we focus very much on wisdom. And so we want to be clear in our minds about the truth. I know I've had this discussion with people as well who believe.
If anyone.
No, compassion.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely, but I guess I just add that wisdom. The important is to have wisdom about things, understanding. To not be. Don't have misunderstanding about things. Okay. Well, thank you all. It's been a lively discussion. Thank you. It's always nice to meet with so many good people. Wonderful Buddhist or practitioners, followers, people interested in the Buddhist teaching. Wish you all the best. Have a good day.
Santa Bhante, thank you. Wonderful talk.